And now for something completely different.
Welcome to Chat with a Cat, episode 17. This is being recorded on the 9th of May, 2025. We have just finished the final regular season sim for season 3. That's the 1982-83 season. So we have our final standings. We have playoff matchups. We have awards. We have lots of things to go through, including a little bit of a follow-up to something that I mentioned on a previous pod, but first off, let's dive into the results. Briefly going through the divisions, the Bullets ran away with the Atlantic Division, finishing with 60 wins. The Knicks had 47 wins. The Celtics made the playoffs with 38 wins, edging out the 76ers, who finished with 35 wins, and the Nets brought up the rear with 23 wins. The Bucks won the Central Division with 55 wins. They'll have the number 2 seed. The Cavaliers had 47 wins, the Pacers 45, the Pistons had 33, the Bulls 28, and the Hawks 19. Out west, your number one overall seed comes from the Pacific Division. That's the Warriors, who finished with 66 wins. Just behind them were the Trailblazers with 64 wins, but they're going to get the number 3 seed since the Midwest champ gets the 2 seed. The Suns finished with 52 wins, the Lakers finished with 47, and the Supersonics finished with 41 to round out the playoff teams. So 5 of the 6 Pacific teams were in the playoffs, and the Clippers came in with 33 wins. In the Midwest, your division winners are the Kings. They finished with 58 wins. The Jazz had 39, Rockets 35, Spurs 32, Mavericks 32, and Nuggets 14. I'll get a little more into, I guess, recaps of each team's seasons a little later, but I wanted to start by taking a look at our playoff brackets because now we know how things are going to begin. In the first round of the playoffs in the East, you're going to have the 3-seeded Cavaliers hosting the 6-seeded Celtics, and you'll have the 4-seeded Knicks versus the 5-seed Pacers, the 1-seed Bullets, the 2-seed Bucks get byes. In the West, the Warriors and Kings are on byes. Your 3-seed is the Trailblazers. They're going to face the Supersonics. And your 4-seed is the Suns, who will face the Lakers. So again, an all-Pacific affair out West. How do I think the playoff matchups are going to go? Well, I'll start in the East with the Cavaliers versus the Celtics. I think the Cavaliers are actually a somewhat favorable draw for the Celtics. Rick Mahorn and Clemen Johnson are solid big men, but they're not overpowering. Most of the Cavaliers' strength comes in the form of their wings, Jim Paxson, Sidney Moncrief, with some help from Johnny Davis and Kevin Porter at point guard. So the Cavaliers are more a backcourt-focused team, and I think that matches up for the Celtics nicely. The Celtics have two bigs that are offensively challenged, but defensive stalwarts in Eaton and LaSalle Thompson, who can kind of clog up the lane. And then they've got Julius Erving and George Gervin on the wings with Mo Cheeks at the point guard spot. So the Celtics, I think, have a puncher's chance against the Cavaliers. Their best scorers are on the wings, as are the Cavaliers. They've got a good distributing point guard, as do the Cavaliers. You could argue that the Celtics might be a little bit better at those positions. I think maybe not Paxson. Well, I guess Paxson and Moncrief have been the Eastern starting guards for the All-Star team the last couple seasons, but it really is close. And so, you know, if the Celtics can use their size inside to bully the Cavaliers, maybe they can come away with the win in the series. I do think, however, that the Cavaliers have a bit of an edge. I would expect this series to, well, here's the thing with saying a series is going to go 6. That would mean it would end on the Celtics' home court. And I don't know that that's going to happen. I don't really see the series going seven. So I think I have to go with the Cavaliers in five. I think the Cavaliers hold serve at home. They take one or two in Boston and then finish things off on their home court in game five. I think the Celtics have put up a valiant run. They've stubbornly refused to give in and tank, which I expect will last pretty much until the offseason begins and they have their own pick. At that point, they're not going to be so worried about finding ways to win. The gritty little Celtics made their run, but I think the Cavaliers have enough to knock them out. The other matchup is the four-seeded Knicks versus the five-seeded Pacers. Up until the time that the Knicks picked up Mickey Johnson and Alex English from the Nuggets, I probably would have leaned toward the Pacers in this lineup. But I think Alex English is one of the few wings that matches up favorably with Adrian Dantley. He can at least stay with Dantley in scoring and occasionally outscore him. And then that leaves, Joe Barry Carroll and Dan Issel for the Pacers as their offensive weapons that the Knicks really don't have a ton of answers for. So they're going to be looking for more backcourt scoring, probably from the likes of Daryl Griffith, maybe Ricky Green. Do I love the Knicks in this matchup? I don't, but looking at their big man rotation between Wayne Cooper, Mickey Johnson, David Greenwood, maybe even a little bit of Michael Brooks, and maybe Alex English sliding up to play some power forward, I think they have enough depth to slow Joe Barry Carroll down. Dan Issel, I think, is a shadow of his former self. He's gone down in scoring from 28 points two seasons ago to 24 points this year to just 15. So I think the name there might be bigger than the actual threat. And because of that, I give the edge to the Knicks, but only because they have home court. If they didn't have home court, I'd give it to the Celtics. So I think this one goes all seven. And again, I'll pick the Knicks. I'm not feeling great about that because probably if you'd asked me six sims ago before the Knicks picked up English, I would have picked the Pacers easily. I'm to the point now with the Pacers. I feel like we've been giving them the benefit of the doubt for a while. And I'm beginning to wonder if perhaps the Pacers just don't quite have the killer instinct we'd like them to have. Pauly won 48 wins and 53 wins. This season, the Pacers are down to 45. So they're going in the wrong direction. It's proof that standing pat with a good team isn't always enough. You always need to be tinkering. You always need to be improving. And I feel like the Pacers have been kind of stagnant, and that does not serve them well. In the Western Conference, I'm going to start with the Suns versus Lakers, and I'm going to breeze through the Trailblazers versus Sonics simply because, again, I don't usually like talking about my own team. I don't think it's very interesting to hear. I think other people, have comments on my team, so I try to make enough commentary to include the other team in the matchup, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. So the Suns and the Lakers were separated by five games this season. I do feel the Lakers were a little bit fortunate to hang on to their playoff spot. I thought the Jazz had a chance to catch them and knock them out, but to their credit, they managed to put together a nice run toward the end of the season and really solidify their spot in the five seed. I did notice that they elected to decline the option on Dave Corzine, which suggests to me that they have decided after spending big on him in the offseason that he's not the answer. Who is the answer? Who do they plan to bring in? Not sure yet, but I don't know that it matters much for this matchup. They're going to be trying to find a way to slow down Bob McAdoo and Tree Rollins in the front court. And as I've mentioned elsewhere, Tree is a very solid defensive center. He's averaging 11 boards, 3.3 blocks, while McAdoo is still an offensive powerhouse, putting up 17 points a game. So you have a nice mix of defense and offense in your bigs. Obviously, the Suns still have Magic Johnson. We're starting to see what the Suns look like with a healthy Ron Brewer, but he's been on the bench since getting healthy. So I think the Suns still have another level that they can get to, maybe by playing Brewer alongside Long at the point guard. That would require Dr. Kavarga to come back and actually make a positive effort on his depth charts. So we'll see if that happens. Even if that doesn't happen, I still think the Suns, by virtue of having Magic, just have a little too much for the Lakers. The Lakers' identity, pretty much since the beginning of the league, has been an offensive force with limited defensive chops outside of James Donaldson, and I think that's still the case. I don't trust the Lakers' perimeter defense. I don't trust any of their interior defenders other than Donaldson. And because of that, I think Magic and, to a lesser extent, McAdoo are going to be able to eat them alive, because at least if positions hold, Donaldson is going to be stuck guarding Tree Rollins, who doesn't really look to shoot much, whereas Dave Corsi is just going to get destroyed by McAdoo. So I see that one going to the Suns probably in five games, although the Lakers are the kind of team that I could see splitting early with the Suns, winning both on their court, going up, having a tie on their own court, so they go back 2-2, and then losing a decisive game six on their home court. They're one of the few teams I could see losing a game six at home, so I'm going to pick the Suns in six here. And that takes us to the Trailblazers and the Supersonics. Obviously, the Trailblazers pushed the Warriors all season long. To be honest, I didn't think I would stay this close this long, so I'm pleasantly surprised with that. I did think that the Trailblazers, and we'll get to this a little bit later when we talk about differentials. I did think the Trailblazers could be a 60-win team, but after last season, I guess the round field pickup helped, but we did lose some of our depth in the offseason and made some other trades that jettisoned some depth, so I'm pleasantly surprised to be where I am. But really what I'd like to talk about is the Supersonics. This is a team that has turned things around mightily since struggling to 9 wins a season ago. I do think they're still trying to figure out how to work with Danny Ainge. Looking at Ainge, he's one of their blue players, but he only averaged 15 minutes on the season and only 4.8 points. Maybe they think he's still raw and not ready yet, which, if I were in their shoes, might be a little concerning. And I say that considering he was the number 5 pick in the draft, and you would hope you'd be getting much more out of him. Obviously, their other early draft pick, Dominique Wilkins, has been absolutely blowing the doors off this year, averaging 25 points and almost 7 rebounds a game. Their aging front court is built around Maurice Lucas, who's 31, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who's 36, Sven Nader is 33. They do have a young Danny Shays, but he doesn't get much more playing time than Nader. It really is Maurice Lucas and Kareem. And I do think it's interesting that for the most part, they played Maurice Lucas at center and let Kareem run at power forward. So clearly they're angling to match Kareem up on a much smaller Dan Round field when we get into the first round. I guess unless they move players around. I think Kareem probably can take advantage of being so much bigger than Roundfield. And hopefully, at least if you're David, he's able to go off. I think the concern I would have if I was the Supersonics is you're going to get scoring out of Dominique. You're going to get scoring out of Kareem. Is Robert Reed your answer for your third score? Is it Ray Williams? And then especially who are your fourth and fifth scorers? And I say that as has been observed that, you know, the Trailblazers don't have a single overwhelming scorer, even following the Roundfield pickup. Roundfield is only averaging 21 a game. David Thompson averages 20. And the Trailblazers do come at you in waves, which is a little bit by design, with eight players averaging double digits. And in any given game, you can have players off the bench even going for 20 or 30 points. So the Trailblazers are kind of built to be a team where you're not quite sure where the scoring outburst is coming from. With the Sonics, you can key your defense on Wilkins and to a lesser extent Jabbar and maybe slow them down. That said, I don't like the matchup with the Sonics as much as I would a matchup with the Lakers or maybe even the Suns. So in this case, I don't want to be tooting my own horn, but yeah, you figure you have a team that won 64 wins against a team with 41 wins. I should be picking the Blazers. I'm going to pick them in five only because, again, I think they'll be able to defend home court and then probably split the series with the Sonics. I don't see them being able to win. If the series goes six, it means the Sonics picked up one in Portland, and I don't see the Sonics in that case losing in six. And I like, given the win differential between the teams, a pick of Blazers in five a lot better than I like a pick of Blazers in seven. So that's what I'm going to have to make. That would set up in the second round a Cavaliers versus Bucks matchup. That one's easy for me. I think the Bucks buzzsaw through the Cavaliers. Bullets versus the Knicks. Again, I think the Bullets are just better. The Knicks will probably regret sending off Buck Williams. I can see Buck going off and sending them home, which would make a Bucks-Bullets series in the conference finals. That one is a coin flip for me, mostly because, yes, there's about five games difference between the teams, but the Bucks haven't had a healthy Michael Cooper all season, and I suspect the Bucks will probably try to throw Michael Cooper on either Walter Davis or Michael Ray Richardson or whoever the Bucks, whoever the Bullets rather decide to roll out at the two, and that lets them take away that. And then Buck Williams is going to be kind of offset by the production of Kevin McHale, and I think from there the Bucks are the deeper team. So I'm going to take Bucks in six in that one. I think if it gets to game seven, the Bullets will win at home. But I think the Bucks probably split the first two games and then it's home court the rest of the way. So give me Bucks in six to come out of the East. Over in the West, it'll be the Warriors, I think, versus the Lakers. The Warriors have pretty much buzzsawed through everybody. I'll give the Suns, especially with Dr. Kavarga here not showing up, very little chance here. I'm going to say the Warriors sweep that one. In the Kings versus the Trailblazers, I think the Kings' late pickup of Bernard King makes them a lot more dangerous, and the Trailblazers do traditionally struggle against Alex Englishes, against Moses Malone, against superstars that can go for 30 to 40 per night. And the Kings have home court advantage, so because of that, I'm going to say the Kings can win that one in seven, and that's going to set up Warriors versus Kings in the conference finals. But here, I think the Warriors are just too strong. They move on in five. So a gentleman sweep, that sets up Warriors versus Bucks in the finals. And I would think, because the finals are 2-3-2 format, I'm going to say you get probably two games won by the Warriors. Then the Bucks go 2-1 at home. And then the Warriors finish them off in game six. So let's say Warriors in six in the finals. I think Moses probably collects his MVP for the playoffs as opposed to the regular season MVP. We'll come back and talk regular season awards in just a couple.
Good evening. In the news this hour, a group of over 400 middle-aged men and women have reportedly convened in Washington, D.C. today for the purpose of making what they call laws. Not much is known about these laws at this time, but early indications are that this group intends for them to act as a sort of guideline for the behavior of American citizens. We'll bring you the full story of this so-called House of Representatives and exactly who it is they represent tonight. More after this.
Bye, Mom. I'm going to school.
Hold on there, young man. You forgot your lunch.
Oh, Mom, it's not peanut butter and jelly again, is it?
Not today, Scooter. Today, you're getting Splat.
Splat? All right!
Introducing Splat. Spreadable lips, anuses, and teats. Moms love it because it spreads like butter. Kids love it because it goes down easy. And best of all, Splat uses the parts of animals usually bound for the trash heap. And in today's waste-conscious world, that's important.
Spreadable lips, anuses, and teats.
Splat!
The yummy alternate.
Splat! Remember, if it spits, craps, or squirts, it's in there.
In other news, Splat lunch meat has been linked to cancer, blindness, anxiety, and male pattern baldness in laboratory rats. Learn more tonight.
It's me. I just wanted to say hello.
Not another boring voicemail message.
Hold the phone! Before you delete that unwanted voicemail, think about those unfortunate people who never get any calls. Don't you think they'd want the message, even if you don't?
Gee, I guess so.
Then press 8 to donate. When you get a message you don't want, press 8. Your message will be forwarded to the mailbox of a fiber optic lonely heart.
Hey, this is Bill. I got your spreadsheet off the webpage, but I had some questions about the R&D headings. Give me a call.
Bill, I don't know what that meant, but you just made my day!
They may not understand the random messages they get, but they'll sure feel more connected. And isn't that what technology is all about?
You know, you're right. I'm gonna press 8 to donate.
Hey, it's me. I just wanted to say hello. Hadn't talked to you in a while. Give me a call sometime. Bye.
I love you, random voice!
Press 8 to donate. Go ahead and touch someone. With other people's fingers.
Antifreeze. Don't drink that.
Why?
Because it'll kill you.
Oh.
This message brought to you by the United States Department of Condescending Paternalism.
We are back, and it is time to talk about the season awards. Your GM of the year this year went to Greenville Airport of the Warriors. I think it's well-deserved. Other people I might have considered might have been the Bucks for basically tearing down and rebuilding completely a new contender from scratch. However, I do think it is more difficult to improve an already good team, and especially significantly as the Warriors did, than it is to build up a poor team. And so in that sense, I think Griepel did a good job. The other contender might have been David with the Supersonics turning around a 9-win team and making them into a playoff team. But I do think everybody has been chasing the Warriors all season. From the time the Robert Parrish trade was announced, that's been the team with the target on their backs. They haven't made many more moves, but they haven't really needed to. That was the biggest move of the offseason. It really has defined the contours of the league and what everyone else is doing. So as far as I'm concerned, it's the right choice. Griepel should be the GM of the year. The computer got that one right. For most valuable player, Magic gets another one. The Suns put up 52 wins despite another absentee season from management. The Suns also had to deal with injuries. Magic carries them again. Moses is, of course, on the team that is doing better, but he's now paired with another all-world talent in Robert Parrish. And that was a team that was already deep in a playoff threat. So Magic is basically doing it on his own. Again, I think this was the right choice. Magic is the MVP. Rookie of the year went to Terry Cummings of the Pistons, who tore up the league, averaging 31 points, 9 rebounds, 1.7 assists. You might have thought it would have gone to Dominique Wilkins, who at least when we opened up the draft files looked like he was ready to go. But man, Cummings just came in like a man on fire. I wonder if part of his production is because the Pistons don't have a ton around him. You know, the Pistons are really built around about three players. And because of that, maybe Cummings got more opportunities than he would have elsewhere. I would think that Marcus Johnson, who's the only player on the Pistons that took more shots than Cummings did, is going to be on the block this season, and I'll explain why a little bit later. But I can see the Pistons deciding Cummings is their guy. You just have to hope that they're not going to decide he's their guy in the same way that New York decided that Buck Williams was their guy and ship him off immediately. For the Defensive Player of the Year, your winner is Mike Gminski of the Kings. He averaged 21.2 points per game, 10 rebounds per game, and 3 block shots and a steal per game. This one, I'm a little more sanguine about. I don't think it's a bad choice. Let me start by saying that. Gminski is certainly a worthy player to win this. I do think, though, it's not like past years where his blocks have jumped off the table at you. If you look in the past couple of years, your blocks leader was the blocks leader by a significant amount. This year, Gminski is actually number 3 in blocks. Alton Lister of the Bucks is averaging 3.5. Tree Rollins of the Suns is also averaging 3.3. Mark Eaton of the Celtics is giving you 3. So his blocks aren't off the charts, which was kind of the case in the past. On the other hand, nobody's running away with steals either. Jim Paxson of the Cavaliers is averaging a couple steals. Michael Cooper, Mo Cheeks of the Bucks and Celtics are also averaging a couple steals, but nobody's putting together, say, a 4 or 5 steal season. So, given that, is Gminski the right choice? Maybe. I think when you take a look at rebounding, even, Gminski is putting up 10.3 rebounds, but Tree is putting together 11 rebounds. So, is Tree out-rebounding Gminski by almost a rebound and match game and blocks offset by the steal per game that you're getting out of Gminski? Maybe, although Tree's getting half a steal. So I don't know. I think you could have an argument for Tree as Defensive Player of the Year. You could theoretically argue for James Donaldson of the Lakers as well, I think, who led the league in rebounds and averaged 2.6 blocks per game. So he's been no slouch himself. Any one of those three I would have been happy with. Again, I'm not upset at Gminski. I just don't think he was a shoe-in. I think Tree Rollins and maybe even Alton Lister, who averaged more blocks and more rebounds than Gminski, had an argument. And I could see, I could see any of those guys winning the award. So congratulations to Gminski and to the Kings for winning it. I don't think it was a runaway. It was probably a close vote. Sixth Man of the Year, on the other hand, I don't think was particularly close. Jamal Wilkes of the Lakers walked away with this one, averaging 21.7 points per game. And even though he's probably a starting caliber talent, he was put on the bench this season as Kelly Chipuka and World Be Free were elevated to the starting wings in Lakerland. And that's probably the right decision. I think both of those players are currently better than Wilkes. Wilkes is still a fine player, but he's not better than two guys ahead of him at the wings on his team. I don't know of any other bench player that even came close to averaging the scoring numbers that he did. So again, I'm okay with Jamal Wilkes getting the Sixth Man of the Year. For the Most Improved Player, you have Lewis Lloyd of the Bucks. That one is kind of an interesting one. He went from averaging 10 points off the bench in Seattle in 18 minutes per game to averaging 18 points per game with Milwaukee in 27 minutes. So his minutes went up by 50%. His points nearly doubled. So that is some actual improvement. Oftentimes it seems like when we see Most Improved Players, it's mostly guy gets more playing time, guy puts up more stats, but per minute he's about the same. But here, I do think there's an actual improvement in Lloyd. I think Doug will probably claim some some credit for developing him as a rookie. But I think it was a case, especially early in the season, before the McHale and Cooper acquisitions, of Lewis just being fed as many minutes as he could eat, and he responded to that. Next, we get to the all-league teams. Your all-league first-team center, in a little bit of a surprise, is your rookie of the year, Terry Cummings. Your forwards, to nobody's great surprise, are Magic Johnson and Moses Malone. I don't think anybody is expecting those guys to go anywhere for any reason other than injury, at least not for another three, four seasons. Calvin Knapp is a starting guard, and Adrian Dantley is your other guard for the all-league team. Knapp feels more like a small forward, but Darth is playing him at guard, so he's eligible to be a guard. And with Knapp averaging 32 a game and Dantley averaging 30 a game, I don't know that I can put forth a good argument for why that should not be the case. So moving to our next area, for your second league or your second team all league, your center is Joe Barry Carroll. Your forwards are Kevin McHale and Alex English. Your guards are Walter Davis and Sidney Moncrief. So, here you get a little bit of a drop off in scoring from Joe Barry versus Terry Cummings. McHale is averaging 29.6 versus Magic's 30.8, and Moses is 30.2, but he's not averaging anything close to their rebound and assist numbers. Alex English, we know he's a monster scorer and a pretty good rebounder and a passer at 7.6 and 4.9 respectively. He's no Magic, but he's probably the next best thing in terms of all-around player in the league. And then with Walter Davis and Sidney Moncrief, you have a couple of guys that are averaging 24 a game. No big arguments here. Both of them are averaging 5 and 7 rebounds and 6 and 5.3 assists respectively, and 1.5 plus steals per game. So they're doing all the things you want your guards to do. And then for your third team, you have Mike Gminski and Bernard King for the Kings at your center and power forward, or I guess forward slots. Kiki Vandeweghe of the Jazz and his 36 points per game. And then Johnny Moore and Reggie Theus. I can see an argument whereby you might say Kiki deserves to be on the second team by virtue of that ridiculous 36.5 points per game. But what he doesn't do is he doesn't give you anything else. He gives you some moderate rebounding, but I think 6 rebounds a game from a forward is nothing special. At the guards, Johnny Moore and Reggie Theus, I think are fine choices. I think you probably had several choices there that you could have gone with. And for the most part, I think it's almost a durability award because I think part of the way that the game scores things in terms of selecting the all-league teams is who puts up the most total stats. So you have guys that miss, say, 5 to 10 games and average similar numbers, they're going to be edged out. And I have to say it would be remiss not to include Johnny Moore, who's averaging 14 assists per game in the all-league team, even if he is averaging only 17.8 points per game. And Reggie Theus, I still think of him more as a shooting guard in my head, but he's averaging 9 assists per game for the Clippers. So, no real complaints. I don't look at this and I think, oh my gosh, yeah, player X was left off and shouldn't be. Maybe Robert Parrish, but I don't know that you can bump, you certainly can't bump off Magic and Moses. And I don't think you can bump off Kiki Vandeweghe or Alex English, maybe Bernard King or Kevin McHale. But, as I look at the numbers, I can't bring myself to do it. Parrish, this season anyway, is only, and again, I use the word only kind of in air quotes, and that doesn't come through on, I guess it's not radio, it's a podcast, but Parrish is averaging only 22 points and 9 rebounds. And you compare that to Kevin McHale, who's averaging 29 points and 9 rebounds. Sorry, Robert, it's not enough. McHale is also doing a great job on blocks, by the way, with 2.7. Going to the all-defense team, we already talked about the DPOY. Mike Gminski of the Kings is your all-league defense starting center. Terry Tyler of the Bucks, whom a lot of people laughed at his contract in the offseason, but I guess he gets the last laugh here. Larry Nance of the 76ers, averaging 10 points and 2.3 blocks, sure. Mo Cheeks for steals, 2.1 steals is good. The one guy that surprises me here is Edmund Sherrod of the Pistons. I hadn't even had him on my radar, but he's averaging 1.8 steals per game. He started all 82 games for the Pistons and averaged 3.5 points to go with 6.7 assists and 1.8 steals. So there you go. An orange-yellow made the all-defensive team. Good for Edmond Sherrod, I guess. Do I expect to see him back again? No. In fact, this is probably the last we're going to hear from him unless somebody does something a little bit crazy. Now, in his defense, he is on a rookie contract, so he'll probably still be bouncing around the league for a while, but I think once it comes time to pay him at that skill set, he probably doesn't do much. For your all-defense second team, Alton Lister of the Bucks makes it. And again, for defense only, I can see that. He's averaging 10.7 rebounds, which is top five. 3.5 blocks, which is top one. Kevin McHale, the Bucks, we talked about him. 9.4 points, 2.7 rebounds. Surprisingly, at least for me, James Worthy of the Trailblazers makes it, despite not having any eye-popping defensive stats. He's averaging 7.5 rebounds. Maybe it's because he's averaging 1.5 steals and 0.6 blocks as a small forward. That's high in steals for a small forward. But, you know, again, I got to be honest, I'm a little surprised at that selection. Michael Cooper makes it at guard for the Bucks. That one also surprises me simply because he missed so much time due to injury. If we were playing with the current NBA rules where you have to play 65 games, he wouldn't even be eligible. He only made it through 55, but we're not playing with that, and he is a great defender. And then finally, Walter Davis of the Bullets, who averaged 1.7 steals, is your other guard. I think there are probably some guards that maybe have a little bit better case for being an all-league defender than does Walter Davis. I think Walter Davis is certainly a better offensive player than most of them. And we all know that when you're selecting all league teams, there is a little bit of offense kind of rolled in there. But, you know, Johnny Moore of the Mavericks averaged 1.9 steals per game. Jim Paxson of the Cavaliers led the league with 2.2. I'm surprised he's nowhere to be seen on this list anywhere, either in the all league or the all defensive teams. So, you know, go figure. Getting to the all-rookie teams, you've got Terry Cummings of the Pistons, no surprise there. Dominique Wilkins of the Sonics, 25 points a game, no surprise there. James Worthy of the Trailblazers, 16 points, 7.5 rebounds, not a huge surprise, I think. Ricky Pierce of the Rockets, 20 points, sure. Rod Higgins of the Clippers, 14 points, sure. Second team, Mark Eaton of the Celtics, 8.8 points, 8.1 rebounds, but rookies aren't doing as much now. Clark Kellogg of the Pistons maybe could have had an argument to bump Worthy off the first team. He averaged 15.9 points, but 9 rebounds, a couple of assists, and a full steal. Paul Pressey of the Hawks, 11.5 points. Terry Teagle and Edmond Sherrod, who we talked about before, the Pistons. So kind of a quirky second team. I do think Eaton, for his defense, will be around for a while. Kellogg, Pressey, and Teagle, I think, eventually become rotation players. They might be sixth men. Could be fourth or fifth starters, but I don't think they're ever going to be all-stars. And Edmond Sherrod, again, you know, we might see him again next season, but I think he's not long for the awards list. I'd like to take a minute at this point to pivot. I'm going to take a very fast break, and then we'll be right back. All right, we're back. So As I mentioned, I wanted to pivot, and what I wanted to pivot to is something that I touched on briefly in either my previous pod or perhaps one before that, but it was talking about one of the best indicators of wins being point differential. And I wanted to explore that a little bit, and I thought about it, it probably works better written out, but I started writing it out, and I was about an hour in, and I wasn't even through the East, and so I thought, you know what, I need to... I just need to get this out. It needs to go a little quicker. So I will apologize for not writing it out, but it's quicker and more efficient, I think, to do it via the podcast. So I misspoke in the last pod. I think I said something to the effect of you're going to be two games over 500 for each 1 point of scoring differential. And that essentially means, you know, if you're at 500, you're 41-41. If you win one extra game, you'd be 42-40, which puts you two games over 500. But that is, and that's a mistake. That would suggest that 1 point differential only improves you by one win. I should have said you're two games above 41 wins for each 1 point of scoring differential. So hopefully by expressing in that matter, it makes it a little more clear. So if you're a plus one, you should expect to see 43 wins. If you're plus two, you should expect to see 45 wins and so on. So going through real quickly, I wanted to take a look at how that matches up with teams' expected wins based on differential and their actual wins. And maybe quickly think of, is there a significant difference and why? So I'm going to start in the East and work my way to the West. So in the East, the Bullets finish with a final point differential of 9.1 positive. We would expect that would win them 59.2 wins. They actually won 60, so that's pretty close. Generally, I think if you're plus or minus two, you're pretty close, and that's within plus or minus two. So right out of the gate, we get a result that matches the formula pretty darn well. The Bullets did a lot of work in the offseason, nabbing Buck Williams. And, of course, they picked up a couple of my players to log some minutes in free agency. I'm surprised Phil Hubbard started as long as he did before they got better. Toward the trade deadline, they grabbed Walter Davis from the Clippers and John Lucas off the Nuggets to boost their backcourt. The Bullets haven't been loud this season, but they've been consistently good. They got the number one seed in the East, and because most of their big moves were done in the offseason, I think Walter Davis and John Lucas are good moves, but I think the big one was getting Buck Williams, and since that was done in the offseason, we have the full measure of the season to compare their point differential to. And they come up basically aligned perfectly with the formula. And no, I did not pick them to kind of toot my own horn as I started off. It's just, you know, the way things fell. The next team is the Knicks in the Atlantic Division. They finished with a final points differential of plus 3.7. That would net them 48.4 expected wins. They actually won 47. So again, we're off by one and some change. So this closely matches the formula. They were floundering at 14-15 when they picked up Alex English. So that probably pushes their potential or their differential, down a little bit. You know, you'd spend about 30 games going below what you should. And that will push your average differential down just a little bit. Then they pick up Alex English and I think Mickey Johnson from the Nuggets. And they went 33-20 the rest of the way. So they came in a little bit low on wins versus their differential, but I think that's probably because they had a significant shakeup mid-season. So it's not quite as easy to pinpoint what they should have landed on win-wise. Next up was the Celtics. Their final points differential was negative 4.5, which means we should have expected them to win 32 games. They actually won 38, and this is a fairly large deviation from the formula. And I think in this case, you can probably explain it by some really huge early losses that they suffered prior to acquiring George Gervin. They lost by 38 to the Knicks on opening night. They lost by 27 to the Cavs. They lost by 48 to the Bucks, 30 to the Nets, 31 to the Trailblazers. Those enormous blowouts are going to push things down. And they actually lost all their games before picking up Gervin by an average of over 10 points per game. So that probably pushes their differential down a little bit because they were just getting so many blowouts. And even if you get blown out by 20, it's still only one loss. So they played about three quarters of the season with Gervin. And so the other way you could look at that is they did a good job coaching to outdo their differential. But I think in this case, it is a case of just some early, really, really bad losses making their differential be worse than it maybe should have been. For the 76ers, they finished with a final differential of negative four. They were expected to win based on that 33 games. They actually won 35. Again, I said plus minus two, I'm happy with. They set their rotation in the off seasons. They didn't suffer any major injuries. They didn't make any major trades. So you would expect this would be a pretty good comparison to the formula. There's not a major roster shift affecting the wins or affecting the margins. There's not an injury messing with things. And, you know, as it turns out, they're within plus two. So, again, the formula is not perfect. And you would think if it was perfect, they would have finished ahead of the Celtics. They did not. So, again, there's some variance here. But the 76ers are probably one of the better test cases for does the formula work. It's close. It's not perfect, but it's close. Next up was the Nets. Their final differential was negative 6.3. That gave them an expected wins amount of 28.4. Their actual wins, 28. So the formula is almost right on the nose. The Nets are a team that I think, you know, they won their title in the first season, and since then they've been a little bit snake bit by injury. Last season, Cliff Robinson missed quite a bit of time. And of course, the big news and the big discussion early this year was Fat Lever breaking his leg. They do have some free agent decisions they're going to have to make this offseason. And at that point, they've got to figure out, was the title run just something that was good luck and the team is really bad? Or is the team good and the injuries are bad luck? And that will probably inform whether or not they want to spend to run this team back. I'm not sure what the answer is, to be quite honest. It's very difficult to get a read on a team when you're constantly missing key players due to injury. So what do I do if I'm the Nets? I'm not sure. I think I probably see what things look like in the draft. Maybe I can find a piece that I'm going to build around. But, you know, maybe I thought I had that last year in Fat Lever and broken legs kind of hurt. So I think the Nets are one of the teams that I have the most sympathy for in terms of trying to figure out what it is they're doing and why. Moving on to the Central, we have the Bucks, who finished the season with a final differential of plus 6.6. That would give them an expected wins total of 54.2. They actually won 55. So, again, formula's pretty close here. They brought in Kevin McHale and Michael Cooper during the season. Michael Cooper was injured, though, so even though that was a big move, I wouldn't have expected it to mess with their final potential pretty much. They actually entered the season on a 9-game winning streak. The Bullets are on a 10-game winning streak, so the top two seeds in the East are looking really good. And I don't think that their final differential is indicative of how good the team is now because Cooper is healthy. So I think they are even more dangerous now than their record would suggest. And they're already getting a bye with the two seed. You know, when I was talking about my playoff picks before, I do think they can run all the way to the finals. So I think the Bucks are definitely back in contention again, whether people are liking it or not. And we'll see how long Quayle sticks with this one before he blows it up. Next up is the Cleveland Cavaliers. They had a final differential of plus 1.1. That would have had them at 43.2 expected wins. They actually won 47, which means they overperformed the formula significantly. You can attribute that either to good coaching or a little bit of variance, or if you prefer, a little bit of luck. And I think it might have been luck simply because they were 11-5 in close games. So those are games decided by 5 points or less. Had they gone closer to 500, that would have put them at 44 wins-ish. So I think it was good luck. But they didn't make any splashy moves on the trade market, but they did bring in Clement Johnson on January 1st when they were 14-14 at that point, and they went 33-21 the rest of the way. And I think that goes to show that flashy moves aren't always required to make your team solid. Sometimes more moderate moves can boost your team's record. It usually takes a flashy move to get a good team to a great team. See the Robert Parrish to Warriors trade. But even a solid move can take an okay team to being a good team. And I think that's what the Cavaliers did this season. So good on them for finding that move. Next up is the Indiana Pacers. Their final differential was plus 4.2. That means we should have seen an expected win total of 49.4. Their actual wins was 45. So they significantly underperformed what the formula said they did. And we can't really explain this away by pointing out injuries. But again, we can probably look at luck. The Pacers were 6-11 in close games. Again, those are games decided by 5 points or less. And they were 1-4 in one-point games. So heartbreak this season. And so this is a great example of, you know, some of the variance you can expect. I say I like the formula when it's within two games, but I've seen, you know, I think, you know, you can have enough variance for it to be five games even, plus or minus up or down. So I don't use it as the gospel, but I use it as something that gives me an idea of where I expect teams to fall and whether or not I expect teams to win. I think Polly is probably a little bit disappointed at the Pacers' performance this season. He had a team that won, I think, 59 games in season one, 53 games in season two. He runs it back and comes back with only 45 wins. So I would expect some sort of move from Polly this season. I think he stood pat for two seasons, and he's going the wrong direction, and I don't think he's going to continue going the wrong direction for long. I don't know that it's a blockbuster move, but I think he will do something to try to improve. It doesn't have to be a big improvement. You know, as we mentioned with Clement, it can be a small improvement. Next up, we have the Pistons, who had a final differential of -6. That would give an expected wins total of 29. They actually won 33. And here I don't have, you know, they lost extra or they won extra close games or they made a big trade in the middle of the season. The thing that I watched when I looked through them that jumped out to me is Marcus Johnson had an awful shooting season this season. He's the only player that shot more than Cummings, but he shot 43.5% while Cummings shot 53%. So if I am Detroit, I'm looking to move off of Marcus or perhaps redefine his role, because a guy who's shooting 43% is not great when you've got Cummings who's doing much better. I think they're going to try to find a way to move some of Marcus's shots to Cummings. Next up is the Bulls, who had a final differential of -6.5. By the formula, that would be an expected win total of 28. Actual win total, also 28. So here the formula was right on. They started the season struggling out of the gate. They pulled the plug on the season, trade away a bunch of their talent. But notably, they did not trade away the player that I thought was kind of their anchor even last season and is still great this season, and that's Steve Johnson. He's not a blue player. He's a green player, but he's got the right ratings in the right places to be a great inside scoring threat and a good rebounder. And they'll probably also build around Craig Hodges, who's not good yet. But as the league starts to open up and we see more threes come into play, I think he could become a threat. They also have 6 first-round picks over the next 3 seasons. And you'll remember, or maybe you won't, but Steve Johnson was the number 15 overall pick. So they've been able to turn late-round picks into quality players. So even if they're getting picks from teams where those picks are late first-round picks, I trust the Bulls to be able to find players that can fit their mold and do well. So I think the Bulls are probably in for another couple of seasons because most of their picks actually sit in 1985. But they will be a team that I think slowly starts to improve. This is probably where they bottom out and they start improving a little bit season over season. I don't know if they'll be a 500 team next season, but I think they'll certainly win more than 28 games. And finally, in the Central, we have the Hawks, who have a final differential of negative 9.4. You would expect them to win 22.2 wins. They actually got 19. They would have been a little bit better if they followed the expectations the formula set. And they basically roll with the same lineup all season. I don't really remember them making any moves. They resisted making a big splash in free agency. Dennis Johnson, still on the Hawks. He turned in another good year. But given the production we're seeing out of other picks from the initial draft, I'm starting to wonder if it's time to start whispering the word bust around number two overall pick Jeff Ruland. Not that he's doing badly, you know, 14 points and almost 10 rebounds is not bad. But when other guys from your draft class are putting up 25 and 10, doesn't look great. With management changing hands just before the draft last season, I don't think the syndicate had enough time to make the moves that he wanted to make. This offseason, he's going to have no excuse. I think they either need to push their chips in now to win around Dennis Johnson, which I think would be a bad idea, or they need to start cashing out assets to build for the future. They're going to have high draft picks. If they cash out assets, they could be even worse next season because, as I mentioned before, the rookies in this class are quite a bit more raw than maybe teams would have liked to see. But, you know, that's one of the things you get when you plan to build around youth is sometimes your youth just isn't ready yet. So next up, we're going to move to the Midwest. Actually, you know what? I may call it at this point just because I think, you know, I'm already almost pushing an hour on the pod. I don't want to needlessly stuff it with extra content, but just a quick comment to follow up on what I said last time about point differential and incremental improvements. I mentioned, and I think the Cavaliers were a good idea or a good example rather with Clement Johnson. Clement Johnson on the season averaged like 8 points, 8.5 rebounds. He's not a star. What he is he's a solid defensive player that that filled a position of need for the Cavaliers, and that took them from a team that was struggling to stay above the 500 mark to a team that was well above 500. They finished 47-35. And, you know, again, it speaks to, you know, adding a solid but not amazing piece can get a team that is mediocre to be good. And it's much more difficult to take a team that is good and make them great, or a team that's great and make them greater. And you can think about this by basically who are you replacing, or is the grammatically correct form, whom are you replacing, I think? I think it's whom. But if you look at the Cavaliers early on in the season and who they were trying to run at power forward, they were running with a starting lineup of Rip Mahorn and Joe Merriweather. Now, Joe Merriweather on the season is shooting 49%, averaging 7 points and 3.5 rebounds. The points are probably comparable to what Clement Johnson is bringing them, but the rebounds aren't. And if you take a look defensively at their ratings, Clement Johnson has a 62 post-defensive rating. Joe Merriweather has a 50. You look at their defensive rebounding ratings, Clement Johnson is 10 points better. Offensively, 20 points better. Block shots, 20 points better. Steals, 20 points better. So even though Johnson's a little bit worse offensively, has a 33 inside to a 45, you weren't expecting Merriweather to be a stud scorer anyway. That's going to be Jim Paxson, Sidney Moncrief, Johnny Davis, Mike Newland. And so by shoring up an area of weakness, your power forward's defense, you suddenly take a team that was struggling a little bit, and you make them into a solid playoff contender. By contrast, if we look at a team that is a solid playoff contender, and I'm going to use the Bullets here, and I'll make it clear why in a moment. The Bullets were already rolling along when they made the Walter Davis pickup. The Bullets picked him up on the 16th, right before the trade deadline. And if you take a look at who they were starting immediately before that, we look at the game on the 10th versus the Nuggets. And in their backcourt, they had Rod Higgins. Now, Rod Higgins was the guy they traded away, but he was averaging 14.7 points a game on 49% shooting. What's Walter Davis averaging? Well, Walter Davis, if you take a look at his averages, is a guy who's going for now, and again, much of this was done on the Clippers, but if you look at him, he's averaging 24 points on the season, but he's doing it in a lot more minutes. So he's an offensive upgrade. He does give you some assists, but just the offensive upgrade doesn't offset some of the defense. He's not a super great defender. He's got a 69 perimeter defense and an 82 steal, whereas Higgins has a perimeter defense of 54 and 54. So you're getting a little bit more in steals from Davis, but you're not getting a ridiculous amount of improved defense, and you lose some on the rebounding edge, where Davis's rebounding is only 25 and 27, whereas Higgins was 51 and 46. So you had to make trade-offs. It wasn't a straight upgrade like Clemon Johnson was. And the Bullets before were doing pretty well. When they made the trade, they were 34 and 15. And if I'm doing my math right here, that comes out to about a 69% winning rate. When they finished the season at 60 and 22, they finished at a 73% win rate. So how much did that trade help the Bullets? Obviously, if they win the title, it was probably worth it. But the upgrade was maybe 4 percentage points of winning. Whereas if you compare the Cavaliers, who go from struggling to stay 500 to 57, that's a 7 percentage points of winning. It's one of the reasons I mentioned I like the Warriors for GM of the Year, because they increased an already high winning rate to the highest I think we've seen in the new league anyway. They went from 43 to 53 to now 66 wins. Do I think he's going to jump to 79 wins next year? Absolutely not. Even adding Magic Johnson probably wouldn't get him to 69 wins the next year. Don't try that, Grepo, please. It's easier to upgrade from 50 to 55% winning than from 55 to 60. It's easier to do that than to go to 60 to 65, from 65 to 70, and so on and so forth. So when you are starting to come back out of bottoming out, be aware that it doesn't take a huge move to move the needle for you. I think sometimes people are waiting for the superstar to drop in your lap. And the only teams that need to get a superstar to move the needle are the teams that are already winning a ton and probably already have superstars. Teams that are toward the middle of the pack or losing, you can make significant strides with smaller moves. So that's the theme of this pod. We're already over an hour. I'm going to tap out. We'll come back for one more week, probably look at some playoff games. But I think the big thing is going to be going over the Western Conference, reviewing how those teams went. Again, probably looking at differential and following up that discussion, and maybe a little bit of free agency preview. But I think I kind of already did that. That was last season. So maybe a little bit of free agency preview. We'll see how it goes. If you have other ideas, again, I'm always open and would love to hear what you'd like to hear from me. So that's it, and we will see you on the next one.